I'm going to start with some poems from the John Fahey book, Requiem for John Fahey. It's a serial poem, which means it's made up of individual poems that are meant to be read all as one piece. And so I'm going to read the first five, and then I'm going to read a couple of things from another chapbook, and then a couple of other poems. But I want to read a biography, or very short bio of John Fahey. The guitarist John Fahey pioneered the use of traditional country and blues fingerpicking to showcase the acoustical steel string guitar as a solo instrument that could play a mix of traditional and non-traditional kinds of music. In the early 60s, he collaged ideas associated with Bartok, Charles Ives, Indian and gamelan music, Tibetan chanting, and Western hymns into often eerie, unpredictable improvisations and meditations. A proficient self-taught guitarist by his teens, Fahey referred to himself and his musical style as American primitive, although he had an MA in musicology from UCLA. During his trips collecting music and records in the South, he rediscovered Delta Blues legends Booker White and Skip James, who he helped get recorded. Fahey released numerous albums and performed from the 50s until the early 90s. He was ranked 35th in Rolling Stone's 100 Greatest Guitarist, but his eccentricities limited him to a cult following. Before he died in 2001, he had stopped many years of drinking, recovered from Epstein-Barr disease, and was playing and recording again. He turned away from his earlier styles, what he called cosmic sentimentalism, and began exploring more experimental electronic music. Sweet Spot. Once in the winter of 1964, I met John Fahey at Mother Neptune's, the coffee house by Los Angeles City College. I was 18, growing out my hair with a joint in my pack of Chesterfields. As I counted on my burning fingers all the trespasses that would raise the lamp, that would cauterize the needle to dip in ink from a broken ballpoint pen, blue stigmata carnations that someday would bloom as music inside my head, or later, now, as words on this page. John came in wearing a blue work shirt, jeans, and a sport coat, which I thought was very cool in those days. He was holding his hand on his head so it wouldn't fall off, someone joked. It was only later that I came to recognize the resolve of the posture. He was dangling a soda bottle by the neck, Jack Daniels mixed with Coca-Cola. He borrowed my Gibson with the faded reddish top and played Christmas songs in open tunings, one after another, until figures in white robes appeared up to their waists in a familiar river in the smoked-up windows of the coffee house, singing low, "How a Rose, Air Blooming," and he smiled once or twice like the Cheshire Cat. We three kings transfigured under the mixolydian colors of a modal star. Sometimes he seemed to move through himself like the current in that river, talking easy to me every once in a while as if we were friends, a slow, droll voice, German philosophy that I didn't understand, of rivers and religion, how he used to go fishing for days at a time with Booker White when the catfish were in bloom. Booker White, who told him, "Be careful what you ask for, John. The past is really out in front of you, before your eyes. The future is out behind. Maybe you need to learn to walk backwards in your own footprints like a Seminole Indian." Joy to the World, fingerpicked and syncopated with a blues turnaround and an old-timey riff. A reverence for the mood, not the holiday. Whatever brooded over that river that we've given so many names. He finished with Silent Night, which he played like a Hawaiian lullaby with the back of a kitchen knife, sliding it up and down the neck of the guitar that he held tilted on his lap like a baby. "Nice little instrument with some decent sustain," he drawled. "You don't see many red guitars. You got a real sweet spot up around the 10th fret on the B string. It doesn't need much tremolo. You can feel it, can't you, in your hands and chest, right through to sound box and fretboard." And I nodded my head, even though I didn't feel a thing. Song of the Turtle. Days gone by when those cool fingers whispered over skin and flesh. His mother's hands fluttered and cooed like birds, nesting, conjuring the murmurs a light in the palm of the heart, touching a rocking softness before he had words to speak, a face that he entered, bigger than the sun, painted and rouged. The perfume, the smell of liquor, coffee, and cigarettes augured the moistness of lips that parted and closed on his neck and chest. She would cool the kiss with a puff of breath and touch the spot with her forefinger, as if to seal it like Solomon's pentagram, drawn on his body in invisible ink that women seemed to notice when he closed his eyes and curved his long neck back and to the side when he played, as if listening for a voice, a cradled humming, when the shades were drawn in the darkened living room. His father worked for the government across the line, AJ, who sang and played the upright piano laid on those heavy ancestral hands at night, who drank and doled out the fruit when his mother left. John, his hair slicked back with Brill cream, just a little dab will do you, John, Aloysius, Fahey. He raised turtles in a concrete pit behind the house. When he was little and the night noise had subsided, the turtles used to sing to him of days gone by when the catfish were in bloom. At the Ash Grove, 1965. As the song goes, ever I get my new house done, sail away, ladies, sail away. I'll give the old one to my son. Sail away, ladies, sail away. His hands shook, so he played the first piece fast, just to burn off the adrenaline. Guitar low on his hip, his head tilted back and to the side, long neck curved, eyes closed, transcendental waterfall. Requiem for the last steam engine train. The maiden voyage of the Yellow Princess. Dance of the inhabitants of the invisible Bladensburg Castle. Imagine Bartok and syncopation, Stravinsky and Ravel, finger-picked on a steel-string guitar. He slid a tarnished lipstick tube on his little finger up and down the strings while his thumbs played the alternating bass and his fingers picked melody and harmony, left hand hammering down, pulling off the pleasures from the slack and sympathetic strings. Open tunings gave him perfect chords in odd and unfamiliar inversions, the spaciousness of open C, for example, the top two strings, both tuned in unison, without the third interval became a drone of B's. The same note played on different strings is not the same note if every object posits its own universe. The regress of overtones reassured us of some kind of order to whatever it was we were crossing. He followed the chromatic descent to the dark root of the tonic, the turnaround and hesitation. Don't look back, John. Whatever's there might be gaining on you. The anticipation of another 12 bars as the steamboat comes around the bend, the whistle piercing the mist before the smokestacks emerge above the willows. The calliope pipes the Tennessee waltz. A Day of the Dead skeleton in the pilot house grins and holds the wheel steady. A deckhand that looks just like you, John, checks the fathoms and marks the twine. And then a hymn, simple and four square when the hour is fulfilled. Jesus is a dying bedmaker, and all who navigate that river squeezed into a tune. A ragga for Mississippi John Hurt, the camp town races, a bicycle built for two. Variations on Saint-Saëns, the maiden voyage of the Yellow Princess. He stabilized the fantasies on the harmonic armature until it had a life of its own, decks of teak and mahogany, a jade prow, and an ivory hull. Not much banter in between songs except for one quiet monologue about how he saw Jimmy Reed perform once, seated in a straight back chair. His wife stood behind him, her hands on his shoulders, whispering lyrics in his ear. I got a bird that whistles and I got a bird that sings, but without my Corina, life isn't worth a thing. John fiddled with the tuning pegs, squinting out at the audience. In the middle of the second set, he toppled backwards off the stool, knocking over his doctored bottle of Coke, clutching his guitar to his chest. Gravity may be one of God's clearer manifestations, along with pressure and coincidence, he mumbled, slowly, deliberately, as he set himself up again. People laughed nervously, but I suppose they encouraged his oddities in exchange for a peek around the bend in that river that we've given so many names. Marking on the twine is 9 fathoms, John. Sail away, Johnny. Sail away. The second age of mechanical reproduction. Gather round, boys. Here we are in the second age of mechanical reproduction, and still so many things that money can't buy. I've played long enough to know that it isn't about how fast you move your fingers. Pure technique is seductive, like some love potion sold off the back of a truck at the end of the minstrel show. Finally, it slows you down. Lots of folks these days with $3,000 Martins and electric tuning machines can play all of John's music at twice the speed that he could, and then some. But they can't find the revenant voicings, the timing, and the touch. He had big hands, and so sometimes he used metal finger picks and played on high gauge strings. There's more nerves in the hand than there are in any other part of the body, he used to say. I spent hours experimenting with the angles, the intensity of the attack, all the variations, how to file my nails, the degree of pressure, what part of the finger presses down on the board, and how close to the fret. How to get that fat, thick sound with the fleshy tips of the fingers. How to tamp and muffle the bass strings with my palm at the same time. How to tune down a half tone to soften the action or take it back up to find the shuffle and the bounce. How much space to leave between the notes and the phrases, whether to bend the note up or down. Whether to play a chord as you inhale or exhale, or hold your breath while you barely remember from another lifetime before you had words. The face of the woman emerging as big as a sun. The perfumed and powdered hands. Perhaps these are not the right questions to ask a dead musician. Not the right questions at all. The heart may not be like a ship in a bottle or a mirror to be polished, but it's crisscrossed with nerve fibers, sympathetic, strung, and open-tuned to any number of moods, all running from the heart to the brain and back again. When he got the jitters before going on stage, John would remember what Book of White told him, how everyone is strung like a musical instrument. John doesn't play the blues anymore. And it starts with an epigraph from Mose Allison. All those middle-class white boys out to have their fun. Elvis took Hound Dog from Big Mama Thornton. Kerner, Ray, and Glover were hanging out with Big Joe Williams and copying every grunt and sigh off those old 78s those days. Tom Rush copped the Panama Limited, talking dialogue and all, off of Book of White. In the early days, John made himself as mysterious as St. Elmo's fire and swamp gas. But in the end, we were all stealing other folks' music, plain and simple, not out of disrespect, but coveting other people's lived experience. What else would you have young people do who wake up living in boomtown in the 50s, like that man who fell to earth, trying to get his bearings when the anesthesia wears off, struggling for air to plug up the holes? I don't listen to my old stuff, John said, not long before he died. Too much like a minstrel show, and I haven't played the blues in years. Believe me, John, Book of White told him, after all these years, my hands are still as hard as the soles of your shoes. And I was there, and there ain't no romance about road gang work or doing time on the county farm or cutting sugarcane along the Brazos with some cracker in sunglasses sitting his horse with a pump shotgun over the saddle, telling you whether you can take a drink of water, yes sir, boss, or take a pee, no sir, boss. No romance in a 9-pound hammer, John. No, sir, boss. Water 'em down. Yes, sir, boss. No romance in dragging a 100-pound bale of cotton. When Muddy Waters got some real money, he bought himself a new Buick and a house in the suburbs. Yes, sirree, Bob, boss. This next poem comes from a series on Garcia Lorca, who was a Spanish poet, probably the best-known Spanish poet of the 20th century. He was killed by the fascists at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. It's called Preciosa, and that's a girl's or young woman's nickname. And it starts with a little piece from a Garcia Lorca poem. verde que te quiero, verde, green, how I would like you, green. Preciosa. A small man, eyes moist like a girl, with shadows wrapped around his waist. I used to roll his words in my mouth with the taste of wine and olives from Jerez de la Frontera and suck them clean. The inflection, pitch, and innuendo, I hid them under my tongue so no one could find them in the afternoons when the wind had chased me back in the house and was gnawing on the roof after Spain had eaten her own children. But in La Taberna Camborio on the Alameda, I blushed when he introduced me to famous whores and flamenco singers of great prominence and regard. The guitarist, Manuel Vélez, El Niño de Huelva, touched my cheek and said I was dark enough to be a gypsy. Pastora Pavón, La Niña de los Penes, the girl of the combs, kissed me full on the lip and put her hand where hip meets waist. At first I twisted in my embarrassment, but did not pull away. The second time, I carefully returned the kiss. They showed me how to drip absinthe into the water. It turned smoky, and the sugar on the filigreed silver spoon caught fire and melted into the green clouds of wormwood, anise, and mint. An aftertaste of veronica, coriander, and lotus flowers. The shadows in the rooms loosened. I was swaying over the deepness of a cistern, perched on the edge of a womb. I went to play the piano, Tárrega and De Falla. It's turned green, I whispered to Lorca. Manuel Vélez played a carcelera, the lament of one unjustly imprisoned, and then accompanied Pastora Pavón, who sang a siqueras. Comb your hair with my combs. My combs are made of cinnamon. I grew my hair long. Before she married Pepe, Pastora gave me tortoiseshell combs. I played the piano for the traveling theater. Que va, Federico, what a perfection of ability. She sight-reads the music impeccably. Buñuel had his eye on me, but he was loud, and I didn't care for his swagger. And Dali, if you look at his painting, La Ver Verde, in the Figueras Museum, you'll see a girl playing a green piano. That year in Cadiz, we watched the old woman win the dance contest simply by lifting her arms, tossing her head, and stamping her foot. Pastora read my fortune in the cards that night. I see an old woman lying on a couch in a darkened parlor. Words are melting in her mouth. This is called Where I Could Visit But Never Stay, and it's for Chris. Alice would play the Bach cello suites in her slip, sustaining the vibrato, her long fingers pressing hard, drawing the bow across the thick, fretless strings to find the tremolo that she said felt like a warm vibration in her breast right through the rosewood back of her instrument. Sometimes she would hum along and look at me. I loved to feel her calloused fingertips when she touched my cheek, the strength of the tendons in her wrist. Clara had a prosthetic leg, but she finished the Ironman in more than a respectable time. I passed her as she ran her uneven gait, the steel skeleton spring released to absorb the shock, the gleaming foot curved like the hind leg of a cheetah. I wanted to know whatever it was that quickened the look on her face, all its zones and chambers, to touch perhaps the facets of pleasure shining behind her endurance and rough technique. Chris could take a cherry in her mouth while she looked me in the eye or up and away to that place where I could sometimes visit but never stay. Her eyes would narrow as she tied the stem with her tongue and then pushed the maraschino cherry out, handed it to me, and smiled. It's an old Alaskan bar trick, she would say, and I would whisper, do it again. These next two come from a chapbook called People of the Air. During the 50s, during the Second World War, Filipino army was drafted into the American army, and they fought the Japanese in the South Pacific. And the Filipino men who fought in that war were promised Social Security benefits and veterans benefits. And many of them immigrated to the United States, particularly to California, to work in the agricultural fields. They never got those Social Security benefits until about 3 years ago, and by that time, of course, you know, 90% of them were all dead. But they were the ones who actually started the Delano Grape Strike in 1965, and it was only after they went on strike that that Cesar Chavez and the National Farm Workers Association really kicked the strike into full gear. So this is called Bahalana, and that's Tagalog, and it kind of means as God wills, or it can mean whatever happens, happens. And it can even mean when one's challenged, it can kind of mean bring it on. So this is Bahalana, Delano 1965, and it starts with a little short quote by Joseph Conrad, and the quote is, "Fiction is history, or it is nothing. But it is also more than that. It stands on firmer ground." And Conrad felt that you could find a different kind of truth in fiction that you couldn't find in history books. At night on Main Street, red lights string muted rubies in the tule fog. Histories of three-card monte, AC Ducey in Mochi's bar. Shy visits to Lola's place behind the starlight bowling alley. Cockfights and knife fights retold in Tagalog and Pidgin English. Eskrima dreams, Bahalana, whatever happens, happens. Lucky Lucay, Julian Baladoy, Rudy Solete, Angel Cabalas, winners of Purple Hearts, Silver Stars and government commendations. Those scouts, point men and coast watchers, those slick-haired boys who jitterbugged in pre-war Manila, who dove for oysters and goggles made from glass bottle bottoms in the lagoons of Cebu and Mindanao, who led GIs from Texas and South Philadelphia through the bamboo jungles. Now they walk toward vanishing points and perimeters, pruning shears slung over their shoulders instead of rifles, asparagus knives and Texas shorties. The straw bosses can never get their names right. They water gardens of winter squash and bitter melon. Men without women behind the barracks in the labor camp cook adobo in outdoor kitchens in Early Mart and Delano. Field pick the lady fingers, the riberas, and the flaming reds. Piecework, pick them, pack them fast, nail the lugs shut, and swamp them into cold storage. Reefer trucks to go south over Tejon Pass, through Castaic Junction into another valley. Angel Cabalas could hammer the fruit crates shut faster than the machine that killed John Henry, the seeds still warm, the flesh of the fruit still trembling. Now in winter, in the thick tule fog, they walk the picket line in army surplus parkas. Outside the entrance to the DiGiorgio Ranch, anting tattoos fade on their calves and chest. Blood tugs from their limbs back to their hearts. They huddle around fires in 50-gallon barrels, remembering their women. They dream histories of Lapu-Lapu, the warrior king who killed Magellan in the shallows with a fire-hardened wooden stick and a bow and arrow. During the strike, I hung around the edges of those fires, warmed my hands, darkened my own soft face over the smoking drums, installing in my silent ear the braveries of others, a boy looking out at the world of men through his thick horn-rimmed glasses, trying to get the stories right. And Rudy Solete and Julian Baladoy and Lucky Lucay, those silver-haired island boys who carried their silver stars and faded purple hearts in beat-up wicker suitcases from labor camp to labor camp, are as real now as this poem, which stands on firmer ground than history. This is the last one. We'll end on a slightly lighter note. It's called Stenella frontalis, and Stenella frontalis is a kind of dolphin. Your playful nips and bumps, the surprising strength of your waist when you twisted out from under me, the smile that never left your face, you seemed to know exactly what I wanted and what I was about to say. Holding my breath, I gripped your fins, bucking and spiraling down, And up we breached into the rolling light, the clouds of birds, your urgent clicks and screams. You whistled in your pleasure, slapped your flukes in the waves, then eased me from your ventral grip and slipped away. I'd like to think if my boat went down, you would come for me, as legend has it, fend off the sharks by ramming them at 30 knots with your bone-hard beak. Then swim beneath me and let me ride the streamlined smoothness of your back until I found my strength. Dolphins are famous for that, aren't they? But the second night when you bit my lip, I remembered tales of dolphins that carried people even farther out to sea. Thank you.